It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted legislative maps drawn by Republicans reversing their earlier decision. Find out what it means for the state's upcoming elections. First, you can call it a comeback. Earlier this month, the state DNR, Madison Audubon, and the Milwaukee County's Parks Department shared that an active bald eagle nest had been documented in Milwaukee County. That means that nests have been confirmed in all 72 of Wisconsin's counties, a recovery milestone for an iconic raptor that numbered only 107 in 1974. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been involved with any organized efforts to observe, document, or otherwise help in the recovery of bald eagles in Wisconsin? What did you do? What did you learn doing that? In general, do you spot bald eagles in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're going to talk about some of the science and ecology of the comeback. First, we wanted to learn about the historical and cultural significance of bald eagles from one indigenous perspective. Kathy Smith is an enrolled tribal member with the Keweenaw Bay Indian community of the Lake Superior Band of Chippewa Indians. She works with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. She's the Manoman Ganawindong, or she who takes care of the wild rice. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Bonjour.
Well, I know there are a lot of different Native perspectives on the bald eagle. From yours, can you tell us about the meaning of bald eagles in your culture?
Well, the eagle is known as Migizi in Ojibwe Mawin, which is our language. And as for eagles, the eagle has a symbol of power and strength, you know, for thousands of years. Eagles are known for their sharp vision, a keen sense of perception, powers of intuition. Eagles also represent action, resolve, and grace, and with great strength, leadership, and vision. The eagle clan also represents, you know, family unit. Both parents, you know, protect and bring food to the eaglets. The eagle, you know, in Ojibwe, people believe that the members of this bird clan pursued the highest elevations of the mind, just as the eagle pursues the highest elevations of the sky. The bird can fly high in the sky, observing the world at great distance. And the eagle is known to be the closest to Geje Manadu, who is the creator, as part of the sky world, and can access his or her wisdom. You know, with our ceremonies, they are the ones that lift the smoke to the creator. As we are filling our asima, or our pipes, and we smoke it with our songs, petitions, and prayers. They're also known as spiritual messengers. Eagles are the keepers of knowledge and responsible for spreading the seeds of that knowledge.
With all that, what does it mean to you to see bald eagles after hitting such a low point, in part because of pesticides and a lot of other factors, the bald eagle making a comeback all over the state?
Well, the sight of an eagle is, you know, really exciting. When we see one, we always say, oh my goodness, there's a Migizi. So when we are at those low points, you know, it's a way of uplifting each other and ourselves, you know. So we always put that asima down, that tobacco, you know, when you petition that eagle. And, you know, it's they're telling us to be courageous, and the dream of a flying eagle or even perched, you know, high signifies, you know, good fortune or victory coming our way.
I've been fortunate enough to see an eagle feather ceremony at a powwow. Can you talk about the significance of eagle feathers?
The significance of our eagle feathers is a symbol of honor, and to give someone or to gift someone, you know, who achieves a task. You know, even in our modern times, you know, I'm part of our Keweenaw Bay Ojibwe Community College. We always give them, you know, at such beautiful events as a graduation from a college or a speaker. You know, if they do beautiful work, even with the youth, we always gift an eagle feather in a good way.
It's an amazing thing to see an eagle firsthand in nature. Do you have a personal memory or experience witnessing eagles that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, I do a lot of work with Nibi, with the water. And as we do our water walk in our community, at the Keweenaw Bay Indian community, we have an annual walk. And just as, you know, we finish this walk, we always see not one, but a few eagles, you know, at the end of our walk. And it just shows a beautiful way of, you know, ending our ceremony and how, you know, it brings our community together and to be able to uplift us, you know, at the end of our walk and to see not one or two, maybe three, and it's just a beautiful way, you know, to end a walk, you know, with that victorious symbolism.
And I know we'll talk to our next guest. The DNR has guidelines about how to not get too close to eagles' nests and show some respect for them. Can you leave us, Kathy, with some thoughts on, you know, appreciating eagles and respecting them when we see them in the wild?
We always have to have that balance, you know, to honor the eagles in a good way. You know, it's part of our stories, part of our culture, and it always teaches us much wisdom and knowledge. And so, you know, we use that also in our teachings from right and wrong. We also use the animals or even stories of the McGeezy. And with our seven grandfather teachings with McGeezy, it also represents love. You know, so it's also bringing that community together for those gentle reminders.
Kathy, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Oh, me gwich.
That's Kathy Smith. Kathy works for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission and is an enrolled member of the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community. Now we'll take a look at the ecological history of the return of bald eagles in Wisconsin. Again, now confirmed active nests in all 72 Wisconsin counties. Richard Stafen is with us, conservation biologist and zoologist with the Natural Heritage Program of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
How excited were you when you heard the news, number 72, now the 72nd county with an active bald eagle nest?
Yeah, certainly I was pretty excited. I mean, I think our whole program and most of the people in the DNR were excited to hear the news. We've been waiting for that last county to be checked off in Milwaukee. So to get the 72 of our counties now is really a great accomplishment.
Let's look back at the road to this recovery. It wasn't guaranteed to come out this way. The early 1970s, a low point for bald eagles around the country, including in Wisconsin. Can you talk about how low the numbers got then and what brought them there?
Yeah, certainly. You mentioned before one of the main factors in those declining numbers was the use of DDT, and other pesticides across the country that had major impacts on a lot of our birds of prey or raptors, including the bald eagle. The number, we started our survey in Wisconsin. It's one of the longest running eagle and osprey surveys in the country. And we started ours in 1973. And at that time, the number of nesting pairs in Wisconsin was 107. It's possible that the numbers might have even been a little bit lower in previous years in the state. The numbers kind of hit their lowest point in the 50s and 60s when DDT was prevalent across the country. And in the continental U.S., the lower 48 states at that time, the estimated number of nesting pairs was as low as 417 in the 50s and 60s. So super low numbers compared to where we are today. And historically, I've seen some estimates in the 1500s and 1600s of eagle nesting eagles in the lower 48, as high as 100,000 nesting eagles in the lower 48 states. So quite a huge decline in numbers. And to put that into some perspective, now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service came up with an estimate in 2021. We're back to around 71,500 nesting pairs in the lower 48 states. So we're getting back close to those historical numbers, but yeah, still a little ways to go. But yeah, we're on the right path.
Getting rid of DDT, a big part of the solution. What were some of the other concrete steps that may have contributed to that comeback?
Yeah, certainly habitat protection is a big one. So the birds, the eagles need large canopy trees, white pines near water bodies for nesting, other large trees, and some of the bottomland forest areas along rivers. We see them nesting in cottonwoods a lot, so protecting some of those large trees. And then just the Clean Water Act and protecting some of our waterways to get them back into a much more usable condition for eagles and many other wildlife species and fish that eagles and osprey prey on was also a key factor in their recovery.
We're talking to Rich Stafen, conservation biologist and zoologist with the Natural Heritage Program at the State DNR. We're talking about the recovery story of bald eagles in Wisconsin. An inhabited nest was documented recently in Milwaukee County, meaning now there have been confirmed nests in all 72 counties in the state. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Where do you go to see bald eagles? Are you seeing more of them now as opposed to a few years ago, 10 years ago? Is there more that you'd like to see done in terms of federal, state, local efforts to protect and conserve the bald eagle population here in the state? Share your questions about bald eagles, your sightings at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about bald eagles and their comeback here in Wisconsin, now sighted, active nests sighted in all 72 counties. Rich Stafen is with us, conservation biologist and zoologist of the Natural Heritage Program at the State Department of Natural Resources. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the bald eagle comeback in the state. Maybe your sightings. Have you seen bald eagles where you didn't used to? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Cordy is with us in Frederick. Cordy, hi.
Hello, how are you? It's always good to be to hear your show. I listen to it daily.
Yay. What did you want to tell us about, Cordy?
Well, I wanted to share with you that back in 1966, my late grandfather bought a 120-acre property up here in West Sweden Township in Polk County. And for the last 20 years, we've had abundant eagles here. I love to watch them all throughout the year. It's so neat to watch those babies grow up and to watch how all those eagles interact. And even though the eagles do eat the abundant population of trumpeter swan babies, I mean, they try to get them, but I am so glad the eagles are here, and I don't want to take them for granted, and I think we should continue to protect them however we can, just like, you know, every protected creature. Sometimes what happens is we start to see a lot of them, and then people get irritated by them, and then they want to not protect them anymore, but I think God has a way of working things out so they all thrive together.
Cordy, I got to ask, you've been watching maybe the same eagles for a long time. Can you attach sort of faces to the same eagle as they grow up? Do you have names for them?
Actually, I do that with the swans, okay, but not with the eagles. The eagles are just interesting to watch, and they're always preying on everything, and we'd love to watch them, and we appreciate them.
Gotcha.
They're so powerful, you know, getting through the winter all year and all that stuff.
Got it. Cordy, thanks a lot for joining us. Rich, do you want to hear from people like Cordy, their reports when they see eagles in their community, long or short term?
Yeah, the one thing that we tell people in terms of eagle reporting is we're mostly interested in eagle nests. So when people see a nest that they drive a particular road every day and they drive that road in the springtime and they see a nest that they hadn't seen before, so the possibility that it's a new nest, or if there's a nest that seems kind of small still to them, that also is a good sign that it's a new eagle nest. Those are the ones we're particularly interested in. We think we have a pretty good assessment or count on most of the eagle nests in the state. So we're really interested in potentially new ones that we don't have accounted for. And by reporting them to us, we can put them into our rare species database then that actually it protects them. So if there was any kind of development or some kind of other disturbance that might take place near a nest, we know about where the nest is and we can better protect it that way.
Thanks for the call, Cordy. And I mentioned earlier, we see an eagle's nest, great, but we don't want to disturb it. How do we make sure we don't bug the eagles while they're nesting?
Well, the one nice thing or great thing about eagles is they've become even more tolerant of people, it seems like. So with this recovery, we're seeing them nesting in areas that are getting closer and closer to people and urban areas in the city of Madison here in Milwaukee County, like you've documented. So they are fairly tolerant of people. And in most cases, when they choose to nest in a location that is high activity area or where there's lots of people around, it doesn't seem to bother them. In some more remote areas where they're not as used to people, there's some setbacks or buffers that we recommend for several different activities. But if somebody were to be out walking, typically we would say that if you're trying to stay at least a couple hundred feet away from a nest, and you usually know if you're too close by to a nest, if the bird would actually fly up off of the nest and would start calling or squawking, that's usually a pretty good sign that you're too close to the nest. So
let's go back.
Take a few to watch them at a safe distance.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Luxembourg. Tom, hi.
Hi. I read several articles lately that eagles of all birds of prey and scavengers are being affected by the lead shot and lead bullets and eating geese that are grabbing sinkers when they're feeding. Does the DNR have any plans to outlaw lead in hunting and fishing?
Tom, thanks for the call. I know this is a long-time concern, Rich. Lead used in hunting and fishing, finding its way into eagles and other birds of prey.
Yeah, it's certainly a major concern. It's actually not one of the leading causes of death for eagles, but it is one of the top three or four causes of death for eagles. And it, if you talk to a rehabilitator, they'll describe the horror of seeing an eagle that's suffering from lead poisoning or dying from lead poisoning. At this time, the DNR does not, that I'm aware of, have any plans to outlaw lead and ammunition or tackle. I think it's up to the folks that hunt and fish to try, and there are alternatives out there that, we would recommend that they would try and shift over to some of those copper bullets or other forms of tackle to reduce the threat that it would cause to eagles and other raptors.
Tom, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Richard Stafen with the state DNR, talking about the comeback of the Wisconsin bald eagle. Well, I guess they're not just Wisconsin bald eagles, but of the bald eagle in Wisconsin, now active nest spotted in all 72 counties. Back to your calls now. John is with us in Two Rivers. John, hi.
Hi. We moved to Two Rivers about 50 years ago, and I bought a lot from a farmer who had retired and lotted off his hay field. And when I bought it, we got to know him a little bit. And he said, well, you know, you're going to notice there's no reptiles out here. There's no frogs or snakes or anything like that, and very few birds. And he said, that's because of we used DDT for 50 years and it's still in the soil. And I guess probably 10 in the river behind my house, the fish were all dead because there was a cheese factory up north of us. And they dumped away in the river, and the bacteria growth killed all fish. So the fish started coming back probably 20, 25 years ago. And about 10 years ago, I noticed an eagle every spring would get a couple of them flying up and down the river. And I never could see where they nest because they fly up into the woods. But the eagle, there's at least one or two of them every year in the spring. And then 2 or 3 years ago, my yard is now in spring is covered with frogs. Huh. And it's just amazed me at how nature can recover from all that abuse.
John, thanks for the call. Rich, maybe an encouraging story there. Changing the way we do stuff can bring back some of that wildlife.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable how stuff can recover and rebound after some major setbacks like that. And I think we see that in some of our other bird populations too. We talk a lot about the 3 billion birds lost that we've documented or has been documented, but there are other birds that are doing fairly well, like raptors and waterfowl and some of the species that humans can help with nesting nest boxes or nesting platforms or other activities that have kind of staved off some of those declines that we see in other birds. And some of the other ones and some of these ones are doing well. So we can play a role in recovery and helping populations kind of persist and see through some of these tough times.
John, thanks for sharing that firsthand report from your own yard. I appreciate it. We heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Claudia, who writes, here in Milwaukee County, we're lucky enough to have eagles in the city of Milwaukee and Bayview. Sadly, the female eagle of the pair has passed away from bird flu just recently, but has had one hatchling make it so far. And I wanted to ask you, Rich, how worried are we? And we're very worried about bird flu in general. How worried are we for bald eagles in particular?
Yeah, they're particularly susceptible to avian influenza. So it's definitely something that we're monitoring closely, our wildlife health folks and other people in the field. I think raptors in general, waterfowl are, definitely at risk. So I think there are major concerns about this, and maybe probably more so than any other thing right now is to continue to monitor what kind of impacts it's going to have on our eagle population.
And Rich, in just our last minute or so, if people want to go out and see bald eagles this time of year, I know the Wisconsin River has a lot of sites we can go to. Where do we have our best chances of seeing eagles?
Yeah, certainly you hit it on the head there, the Wisconsin River. Some of our major water bodies, rivers, Mississippi River, Chippewa River, Black River, there's eagles nesting there. Some of the highest density of nesting eagles in the state is in the north central part in Vilas and Oneida County, and then in southwestern Wisconsin, Crawford and Grant counties along those major rivers. And up north, it's along some of our numerous water bodies like lakes and ponds and stuff up there too.
Rich, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Richard Stafen is a conservation biologist and zoologist with the Natural Heritage Program of Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. With us today to talk about the comeback of bald eagles in the state after the discovery of an inhabited nest in Milwaukee County, marking the bird's return to all 72 of the state's counties. Now, the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted legislative maps drawn by Republicans in a 4-3 ruling this past Friday. Justice Brian Hagedorn was the swing vote after he originally voted in favor of Governor Tony Evers' revised maps in March of this year. But the United States Supreme Court struck down Evers' maps over questions about the Federal Voting Rights Act. The maps were then sent back to the Wisconsin Supreme Court for reconsideration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you happy with this outcome or worried about it? Are you curious about how this will affect the election this fall? What questions do you have? How do you want these lines drawn in the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Johnson is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, co-host of the Mapped Out podcast. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Rob.
And John Johnson is a research fellow in the Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education at Marquette University Law School. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks.
Sean, let's start with you. We had a decision from the Wisconsin Supreme Court, went to the U.S. Supreme Court. They threw it back. What was the objection?
The objection from the U.S. Supreme Court is that the way that the Wisconsin Supreme Court initially handed down its decision was an improper application of the, you know, the Federal Voting Rights Act with regard to the way the Evers map drew seven black majority assembly districts in Milwaukee. I guess the shorthand of it is that the U.S. Supreme Court said the state Supreme Court did not follow the correct precedent when it came to determining whether these districts should be drawn with race in mind. And because of that, it was back to the court to start all over again, essentially. And, you know, in this case, the court just chose another option.
John, that option they chose was the map drawn by Republican lawmakers, passed in the legislature, vetoed by Governor Evers. What does this map end up meaning for the Republican-Democratic split in the legislature?
It reduces the number of competitive seats by quite a lot. And by my calculation, I expect it to mean that there's going to be about 63 assembly seats that lean Republican. So the map will actually favor Republicans a little bit more than, say, the existing maps did in 2020.
If there's an evenly tied vote in the state for the legislature, and, you know, this we get pretty close to there in statewide elections, what happens then in the outcome of the vote? About half the people vote for Democratic lawmakers, about half vote for Republicans. In that 50-50 scenario, what does the legislature look like?
Given where Democratic and Republican voters live right now, based on the last few big elections we've had, it looks like about 63 seats going towards the Republicans, 36 towards the Democrats. It would be easier under the new maps for Republicans to win a supermajority than it would be for Democrats to win just 50 seats.
Sean, what would that mean if Republicans had that supermajority in the legislature, supposing, with a hypothetical, they managed to get that, but don't manage to take over the governor's office?
So in that situation, let's say that, you know, it's a Republican year, but Governor Tony Evers prevails in November and he's still governor. He's, you know, we've seen what he's done this past session. He just vetoed a record number of bills for a single session for any governor in Wisconsin history. And so, you know, he maybe can't get everything that he wants accomplished in Wisconsin state government right now, not by a long shot, but he is there to stop Republicans. If Republicans were to cross that supermajority threshold, that two-thirds threshold in both the Assembly and the Senate, and they kept all their members together, they could do what they want despite the governor's objections because they could override him. That's something they can't do right now despite big majorities in the legislature. But once you cross that two-thirds majority, the legislature gets a lot more powerful.
And John, one more way of looking at it. You mentioned it would be easier to get the supermajority for Republicans than any majority for Democrats. Approximately what would have to be the vote skew in favor of Democrats to give Democrats a shot at a narrow majority in the legislature?
Democrats would need to get about 56.2% of the two-party vote to have a good shot at winning 50 seats. By contrast, Republicans need to win about by about 7.2 points, so 53.6% of the two-party vote to get a supermajority. Now, to be clear, that would be a better Republican performance statewide than they've had for quite some time. Scott Walker, despite being reelected over and over again, never achieved a victory that large. Neither has Ron Johnson or, of course, Donald Trump. We can imagine a really good election year for Republicans where they might achieve that large of a majority, but it would be unusual given how closely divided Wisconsin has been for the past several decades.
We are talking about the state legislative maps approved by Wisconsin's Supreme Court favoring Republicans, a Republican plan from the legislature. John Johnson with us from Marquette University. Sean Johnson, State Capitol Bureau Chief here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and with you at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nancy is with us in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. What I wanted to bring up is I had worked a lot with the FAIR maps, and the U.S. Supreme Court didn't really strike it down. They just sent it back to the state saying more or less they wanted, you know, show us your homework of how this is affecting the Voters' Rights Act. And another thing, you know, we waited and waited for an outcome. Why did the outcome have to come at, say, 4 o'clock on a holiday, you know, weekend, you know, Friday at 4 o'clock when nobody's paying attention?
Nancy, thanks for that call. And Sean, the timing is relevant, not just because of holiday weekend, but also it was a key milestone in the 2022 election campaign, right?
Yeah, Friday was the day that candidates began circulating nominating petitions to run in these new districts. And so you began that day in the morning with candidates potentially circulating those petitions, but not having districts to run in. The State Elections Commission did move ahead with telling candidates, here are the new congressional districts. Here's where you'll be running for these. But just basically told candidates, consult your own attorneys when it comes to whether or not to, you know, what they were supposed to do with these state legislative maps. So timing was definitely key. This was about as late as they could have done it and not been, you know, even more disruptive, I guess. They kind of did miss the deadline in a way. And we don't know what was going on behind closed doors in terms of why it took until it did for this to happen. I mean, Brian Hagedorn was the key swing vote in this case, as he is on so many cases before the Wisconsin Supreme Court right now. He wrote a 4-page concurring opinion, kind of giving us a sense of why he went with the, you know, the conservative majority this time, and you know, went with the court's liberals back in March. But we don't know why exactly or what was happening behind the scenes and why it took until this very last minute for this decision to come out.
Thanks for that call, John. Sean just mentioned the congressional district maps. The state Supreme Court went with the Evers, a revised congressional plan. The U.S. Supreme Court was cool with that. What does that mean? What does that mean for potentially competitive races here in the state for Congress?
You know, that is actually a fairly big deal, because it means we have two reasonably competitive seats instead of just one in Wisconsin. The third district has been pretty competitive for a long time. It's had a longtime Democratic incumbent, which has helped keep it in that column. But say Republicans are kind of licking their chops looking at that district, given their growing strength in rural areas. But the first district, which has some smaller cities in Wisconsin and also some suburban areas, under Evers' map, that becomes a little bit more Democratic leaning. It looks like a place that in a good year, Democrats will be optimistic about picking it up. There's something for both parties in this map at the congressional level.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm not pleased with the decision, regardless of what it was going to be. Figured this means at least several more years of the legislature essentially not having honest elections. But now this also means that if we wanted to have honest elections back for the state legislature, not only would we have to elect a Democratic governor the next time there's a census, but also flip some of the seats in the state Supreme Court so that they don't do something like take a court case that arguably they should not have in the first place.
Nate, thanks for the call. Sean, Nate pointing toward the long-term impact potentially of this decision on what the legislature is going to look like, certainly for the next 2 years, possibly for the next 10 years.
It could potentially be the map or pretty close to the map until 2032. So as with all these redistricting decisions or redistricting maps, it's a very consequential piece of policy. And, you know, this is a map that bears, you know, much resemblance to the one Republicans drew in 2011 after they won the 2010 wave election. So to just kind of pause and think that that wave election set the stage for them to have a Republican friendly maps for the next 20 years, pretty big deal. As far as going forward, you know, one election I would highlight that nobody's going to be thinking about at this point, but I think will probably be a big deal once we get there, is the 2023 Wisconsin Supreme Court election. That'd be the year that Justice Patience Rogensack would be up for election. She's not expected to run again, I don't believe. And so, you know, that could potentially tip the ideological balance of the court. And when you're dealing with just, you know, decisions as consequential as this one, a seat like that is going to come under heavy, heavy focus from the parties.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sean Johnson, State Capitol Bureau Chief for WPR, and John Johnson from Marquette University Law School, looking at the state's legislative district maps after the state Supreme Court approved a plan passed by Republican lawmakers. You can join in still at 800-642-1234. Do you have concerns about the redistricting? Are you happy with the ruling? Are you curious about how this could affect you and the district you vote in? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk now with Sean Johnson, State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, and John Johnson, Research Fellow at Marquette Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education, with us today to talk about the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopting a Republican-drawn map for state legislative seats. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that decision handed down on Friday. your questions, your thoughts, your hopes for the future on how we draw these things. Call 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hi.
Hi. I kind of have a comment question or two-part question. This decision is super concerning to me. And I think it should be concerning to every citizen, because it just seems like if anyone gets a supermajority, it just seems very anti-democratic, small d. And I guess also, I don't know if you're familiar with the phrase, like, the two-party system serves itself. So any thoughts on how to get out of this cycle? And just curious to hear your insights or comments.
Louise, thanks for the call. John, any thoughts on Louise's questions?
I don't think, I think as long as we have single member districts with first past the post voting, the system that we have here and in most parts of the country will continue to have a two-party system like this. But there are a lot of people who are promoting alternative ways of running elections. Ranked choice voting is a popular one that's been introduced for some mayoral elections around the country. That's where you have more than two candidates running, and you rank your order from one to, if there's six candidates, six, and then those ranked choices are used to choose the winner if no one gets an outright majority of first choice preferences. So there are some other ideas, but I think it would take a structural change to get away from the two-party system that we have here.
Louise, thanks for the call. We'll go to Louie now in Oconto. Louie, hi.
Yes, I think one thing that might help get voter turnout is kind of the voters trying to override this gerrymandering and saying, you're not going to tell me how to vote. We're going to vote the way we want to, and we're going to turn out to oppose this gerrymandering.
Louis, thanks for the call. Sean, there is backlash to gerrymandering around the state, but has it shown itself so far to be a force that could change outcomes in elections?
You know, I mean, it's never over until people vote, right? But these districts are drawn with such precision, and there's just such a history of, I guess, the map makers being right. I mean, you can look at the way that the last decade went in terms of how Republicans kind of thought it would go when they drew that map and how it went. They're pretty good at it. And so it's not over till elections happen. There could be voters who stand up and say, I don't care which way my district leans. But I'm not sure that redistricting is, as a political issue, is enough of a galvanizing force to kind of get people together and, you know, throw somebody out. There's no, as far as like getting together and having some kind of a citizen initiative, you can pass advisory referenda. And a lot of communities have, a lot of counties around the state have gone on the record saying that, you know, they favor nonpartisan redistricting, but it's just advisory in Wisconsin. And there's no citizen initiative here like there is in some other states. And when it comes to amending the Constitution, that requires the legislature to get involved. They have to pass a proposed amendment a couple sessions in a row before it goes to voters. So there, you know, the legislature's power kind of shows itself again.
Thank you, Louis. John, I've talked to Republicans on the show about the maps, and they say, well, this isn't really gerrymandering. There's a natural tilt. Democrats tend to cluster up in cities. Republicans spread out. Sean talked about this on the Mapped Out podcast, of course. How big a factor, John, is this in the maps we end up with? Are these maps more skewed than that natural skew that they point to?
Oh, way more skewed. No one serious would suggest otherwise. I mean, you can use algorithmic redistricting to sort of simulate if you drew, you know, hundreds of thousands of maps without any regard for where Democrats and Republicans win, but keeping them contiguous as the law requires. And those sorts of things show that if you drew sort of totally neutral maps in Wisconsin, you would probably have a Republican advantage of, you know, maybe 10 seats or so in a statewide tie. And so these maps increase the number of Republican seats But perhaps even more importantly, they reduce the number of competitive seats in either direction. So if you had neutrally drawn maps, you would have many more state assembly districts where either a Republican or a Democrat could plausibly win from year to year. Now, there's only a handful of places where it actually feels like the outcome is unknown before Election Day.
Let's bring on another caller now. Rita is with us in Greendale. Rita, hello.
Hi. I remember 10, 12 years ago when they boasted about the software that specifically did the gerrymandering for them. They announced it on the news, how proud they were that they tweaked it as much as they possibly could. Obviously, they realized that wasn't too wise, so they didn't boast this time. But it just shocks me how they keep being able to do this.
Rita, thanks for the call. Sean, you remember that as well, the process that was used. And the new software really lets you get very granular in drawing these lines, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when Republicans drew the map, they were pretty quiet about it initially in 2011 and didn't share too much. I think a lot came out over the course of multiple federal lawsuits and through discovery from Democrats who sued to try to overturn the maps. And that's when you saw some of these messages between Republican operatives and map drawers talking about just how, you know, precise they were getting with some of these districts. And technology has gotten better since then. I mean, I think people's views of it are more sophisticated now than they were a decade ago. John would certainly be able to speak to that better than I can, but it's not like we're going back to, you know, pencils and paper with erasers, which is a thing that actually happened a few decades ago. It would be how we drew a map. We're a long ways from that now.
Yeah, John, do you have thoughts on how technology allows more and more precise gerrymandering?
Yeah, Rita is dead on the money about that. The technology is more widely available this time compared to the previous redistricting cycle. And so now sort of independent researchers like me are able to use some of the same tools to evaluate redistricting. But that certainly is a change from, say, the 2000 cycle. But I will say that I think kind of an underrated reason of why gerrymandering works so well now is that voters themselves are much more predictable. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the 2000 presidential election, there was not a particularly strong correlation between how people voted for the presidential race compared to how they voted in the assembly race. You would have people splitting their ticket in both directions between Democrats and Republicans. Now that kind of ticket splitting is much less common. And so it's much easier for would-be gerrymanders to say, well, if we draw the lines here, we're very confident that these people will vote for Republicans or Democrats. That didn't used to be the case. And so your sophisticated map drawing software only works when you have predictable voters, which now we have.
In our last few moments, Sean, there could still be federal court challenges, but because of the timing, it sounds like it's very unlikely that any federal court would now step in to change the maps for this year's elections. Do I have that about right?
Yeah, my understanding is that while Democrats or, you know, groups they work with may try to challenge this, I mean, almost certainly will try to challenge this in federal court, it's not likely to affect the 2022 election. So the maps that you see now, the Evers plan that for the congressional districts and then the legislature's plan for the legislative districts are certainly, you know, the likely maps to be in place. I think we can say those are the final maps for the 2022 elections at this point.
Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Sean Johnson, State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, and John Johnson, Research Fellow at Marquette Law School's Lubar Center. They join us for a look at redistricting in Wisconsin after the state Supreme Court approved a map drawn by Republican lawmakers.